Thank you for downloading this podcast from policyreview.tv.
Thank you very much for the opportunity to come and tell you a little bit about the Local Government Ombudsman, what we do and what I'm currently thinking about this issue of accountability at the moment. I think probably the subtext to my contribution might be from the other end of the telescope, because I want to give you a bit of a flavour from some of the complaints that we receive about just how it looks from the citizen. And some of the intricacies that I'm observing in how citizens can hold service providers to account at the local level. So I'd like to begin by, as I say, just telling you a bit about what we do. I want to talk about the whole notion of the contract between the citizen and the state and forms of local accountability. I want to give you some examples from some real cases that we deal with, and then leave you with some of my thoughts about how we can ensure better accountability for service failure in the future. The Local Government Ombudsman continues to provide a free, independent service where we conduct impartial investigations of complaints from individuals to remedy injustice caused by maladministration or service failure. And that really is the USP. We are looking at individuals who have been caused injustice by a service having failed at the local level. What we seek to do is to put the complainant back in the position they would have been, but for that fault. And if action can't be taken to achieve that, then we will seek to agree some kind of compensation. We also look to put things right for others in the future. So we're in a kind of quasi-judicial role. We're certainly in the business of administrative justice, but we're not the courts, we're not the regulators. We have a distinctive alternative dispute resolution position, if you like. Whilst many of you will know, we've focused in the past on that sort of clunky term maladministration, for which there is no precise definition. But now we are very much looking at service failure, and recent legislation has amended our role, in particular in relation to adult social care, and I'll mention something about that in a moment. And that is very much part of our statutory duty and the work that we are conducting. So, what is our role? Well, I see our role very much as being, if you like, the mediator between the citizen and the state. Citizenship brings a lot of rights with it. Those of you who are interested in the literature will know it's about social, civil, economic and political rights. We might more usefully today talk about human rights, issues to do with equalities. And those very much underpin what citizens can expect. It's the role of the state, therefore, in my view, to protect and secure those rights. But there are also responsibilities on both sides. This is an old argument. It's been going for some time. And what I find myself asking when I'm considering complaints that come to me is what is reasonable, what is fair, and what is proportionate, particularly when I'm considering complaints that have been brought by the vulnerable, the old, the very young, or the disabled. So for me, it's very much weighing up in the balance what is that right balance of rights and responsibility. That, in effect, is what I see as the role of the ombudsman. But the bottom line, of course, of all this is that the state must be accountable to citizens for its actions taken on their behalf and with public money. When public services fail, when they go wrong, the consequences can be catastrophic. Often it's about small things that illustrate bigger issues. But if we're talking about special educational needs, homelessness, adult social care issues, very much in the news at the moment, some planning decisions, questions of how we deal with looked after children, environmental pollution, healthcare. You can see from that very list that we are actually very soon into issues that matter very much to people's everyday lives. For many of these citizens, there is no plan B. There is no exit. So we might want to apply consumerist models, but many of these people are dependent in one way or another. So where is the proper balance of rights and responsibilities? I'm going to pick up very much the threads that began in the earlier session, and I confess, you know, I'm very happy to confess that I'm very much within the CFPS paradigm, and indeed we've even got a little box which has complaints in it, even better. But I agree that there are broadly three forms of local accountability. The first, and Jessica referred to these earlier, is around democratic accountability, direct and indirect. You know all this, I don't need to labour the point. But it is about the way in which local authorities and elected representatives understand and respond to local communities and their needs. It's that local collective, if I can use that term. But we know that the public are at best disenchanted with some of those arrangements and at worst apathetic in relation to elections and the like. So it's a good form of accountability, but it only goes so far. The second form of accountability is what I would term professional regulation and inspection. It's something we've come to know and love over recent years and now is being rolled back. I make no point about that, but just to say that it seems to me that the public information, the quality standards, yes, even the league tables are an important part of a local accountability framework. It works very well in helping individuals make their choices and hold to account services that are being delivered for them. I did research on education several years ago. It seems to me that the Ofsted, the parents' meetings and all of that seemed to work pretty well. Parents absolutely knew that if they were going to choose a school, they needed to have a pretty good look at the Ofsted report. And if you were down the league tables with an Ofsted inspection, that meant bad news. Just one example, of course. The third element of accountability is what I would term consumer accountability, and that is very much where I think the whole complaints framework absolutely sits. And we can see more and more, and particularly in the white paper, that this is certainly the current direction of travel. It's all about needs-based choice. It's all about direct contractual relationships between the citizen and the state or those providing on their behalf. It's all about diversity of provision and a competitive market, or at least a mixed economy. And we heard a little bit about that from Jed before. So it seems to me that we need to hold in tension these forms of accountability. And if the first two, as I'm arguing, are weaker or being weakened, then the question for me is how consumer accountability is going to take up that slack. And if I had a diagram that I wanted to show to you now, I'd be putting the consumer, the citizen, in the centre of that. And I'd be saying, how can the two arms of the accountability, the regulation on the one side, the democratic accountability on the other side, actually help to support the third arm? There is clearly, of course, a changing local landscape. And we've heard already, particularly from Paul O'Brien earlier on, and I very much endorse his comments about the mechanisms of accountability that can be achieved out through contracting and the like. Certainly, we've heard there are a whole number of new models of local delivery which are being proposed, and these very much build on mechanisms we've seen over the years. So in some senses, nothing new there. But the Public Service White Paper certainly, if you like, ups the ante. It focuses very much on the local authority commissioning role and is very much about ensuring individual choice through a diversity of providers. This leaves me with a particular question, which I want to illustrate with some of the complaints that we've received recently. The question for me really is, how does a citizen know who to hold to account and for what? Because I think this is becoming increasingly complicated. I think it's complicated particularly for two reasons. The first is, where does authority lie? We've already touched on this in the contributions that we've heard this morning. Where does authority lie for service provision? Who has the statutory duty to provide? How do commissioners hold providers to account? How do citizens hold commissioners to account? And can commissioners pass on their duties to the provider? Now, I know I'm just summarising here some of the things we've already heard, but I think it's worth just pausing and thinking there are kind of five questions there which the citizen has got to try to understand. Even the language is confusing. Do most people understand when they're talking about a commissioner or provider? Well, I don't think so. The second point is about funding. You know, bottom line, follow the money. Who funds this? Is this state funded or is this privately funded? And we have I'll talk about adult social care responsibilities in a moment. So here's just a couple of examples from complaints that we've received in my office over recent months or so. And I picked these examples quite deliberately because I think they do illuminate the issue. I want to talk about disability facilities grants. I want to talk about statements of special educational needs. I want to mention direct payments, and I also want to mention school admission appeals, all things within our purview, all issues that come through to us as part of our jurisdiction. So if I may, I'm just going to read this because it helps make my point. This is from a statement of reasons that we issued in connection with a complaint from an elderly gentleman who had kidney failure, who was complaining about the way in which the local authority had not provided shower facilities for him in his home. And this just gives you a flavour of the issues here. First of all, the NHS and Community Care Act 1990, so I should be precise about this, requires the council to assess the community care needs of anyone coming to its attention who might be in need of community care services, which it provides, and to provide the necessary services if a person meets any eligibility criteria the council has set in accordance with government guidance. So I think what that's telling me is there's a statutory duty to provide here. Second point, the provision of services, including equipment and adaptations to a person's home, may be made under a number of legal provisions and government guidance, in particular, Department of Health guidance delivering housing adaptations for people with disabilities, not surprisingly. Adaptations to public sector housing may be funded directly by a housing authority or landlord or by way of housing grant, but the principles of which work should be funded publicly are the same. I take that to be my investigator's point at making about what are the funding issues here. The third point here is about then the actual provision of the service. In this case, this council and its primary care trust, now replaced by NHS trust, had established a joint body, the One Stop Resource Centre, I hope that doesn't give them away, which among other things carries out occupational therapy assessments of people's needs for equipment and adaptations to enable them to continue to live independently in their own homes, etc., etc. The OSRC was managed by the PCT, but carries out social care functions on behalf of the council. This is complicated. Now, I'll leave it there. As a result of our investigation, I'm pleased to say that the council decided to give a direct payment directly to the complainant to arrange with the contractor to have the appropriate works carried out. So, you know, we had a good result. But the point I'm making here is that's pretty complicated. Also on the issue of disability facilities grant, there was a report that I issued in November, actually, and it was in relation to Northampton Borough Council. It's a matter of public record, so I can say it here. And if you care to look at that, you'll see that was to do with when a grant was refused because the complainant was a tenant in rented property, not an owner-occupier. We found that was not the right thing to do, and that was what the subject of my report was. But what this also highlights is that in terms of these grants, there is, on the one hand, a contractual relationship between the citizen and the builder, and often in those circumstances, the citizen will say, well, I'll have a bit of extra work done here, and I might actually do this, or I might do something differently. But at the same time, there has to be a contract with the council and whoever's providing the works to be satisfied that public money is being spent adequately. I think I've laboured the point enough. You can see that it's complicated. Second example is about special educational needs. Some of you may already be well versed in this, but I want to again do the same thing and just quote from a statement of reasons in relation to a complaint where the council had failed to ensure adequate special educational needs provision for a young person. So to put it briefly, in my case, it says that we say here, the law does not allow the ombudsman to investigate a complaint where the complainant has appealed to a tribunal to resolve matters. There's already the issue of what I can do versus what a tribunal should do, and citizens have to negotiate between our two roles. The law also does not generally allow me, the ombudsman, to investigate the actions of a school. There are some exceptions, but they do not apply to this particular location. We did have a pilot scheme which the last government initiated to allow us to look at the internal management of schools. So this government has decided they don't wish to continue with that, and it has been repealed in the Education Now Act. So the bottom line here is that whilst we look at what local authorities do in relation to SEN, we can't look at what schools do in relation to the provision. Interesting example. But in terms of this case, the bottom line here was that the council's actions should be based on the Education Act 1996, section 19(1), which states that the local education authority shall make arrangements for the provision of suitable full-time or part-time education at school or otherwise than at school for those children of compulsory school age who, by reason of illness, etc., are not able to receive suitable education. Bit of a mouthful. But again, that's the statutory duty. So I'm pleased to say that as a result of this investigation, we did agree a satisfactory settlement, in fact, because the complainants here had gone ahead and actually paid for adequate provision when the council was not providing it, and we asked for that money to be repaid. My point here is not necessarily to bang the drum for what the ombudsman can achieve for you, but just to say that here again, in terms of special educational needs, it's complicated. In terms of direct payments, I will just say that we see too many complaints about the failure of this process. Certainly some of those were in the early days and we were all getting to grips with what it meant. And certainly there were complainants who were not advised appropriately by the council. And very often we saw complaints where, yes, the direct payments had been made, but for one reason or another, the complainant in our case had just not had the wherewithal and the support to be able to spend the money effectively. And at the end of the day, that leaves me with a question as to, well, who actually is accountable for the quality of that service provision? Final point, and just briefly in terms of our examples, is around school admission appeals, which we have within our jurisdiction. We have a current problem, which we're discussing with the department, so I this is absolutely time limited, but again, it just, I think, is an interesting example in relation to academies. Those schools that are adopting academy status are outside our jurisdiction. So we have a number of examples at the moment whereby we can see that a complainant probably has a case where an appeal was not handled effectively when the school was still maintained, but because the school has now become an academy, the school is outside of our jurisdiction and we can't achieve a remedy. So we take the view that there is no point in initiating an investigation in those circumstances. We are talking to the Department for Education about this, and of course that's a time-limited issue and it may change. But it's just an interesting example, isn't it, of where a service, in this case the school, is changing its status and where we've not thought through the line of accountability that goes with it. Last but not least, I will just mention adult social care services, because until around about 12 months ago our jurisdiction was for local authorities as the commissioners and funders of adult social care. You will know, of course, that now many citizens are privately funding their adult social care, and so our jurisdiction was changed so that all those 13,000 or so social care providers registered with CQC are within our jurisdiction and the complaint can now come to us. So again, it's just an example of a changing landscape and how we need to make sure that we're relevant in order that accountability can continue. So, just a final few remarks on the back of that. I hope that's given you something to think about. Seems to me that the most effective forms of accountability are direct forms of accountability. Accountability is, after all, a relationship. And when it is mediated by two or three or four parties, clearly that relationship becomes complex at least, and worse if it's not handled properly. Any provider of a public service should be open to the views and concerns of their users, and that includes our service, of course, as well. And any provider of a public service should see complaints in a positive light. It may be too far to say that we should regard each complaint as a gift, but you take the point. This means that I think we need to just think very hard at this particular moment at how we assure a simple and effective route for complainants to voice their concerns and, moreover, for them to achieve remedy. All ombudsmen, absolutely support complaints being effectively dealt with at the local level, and we for many years have supported the way in which local authorities do that. I think we're back to turkeys and Christmas here, aren't we? But absolutely must be addressed at the lowest possible level. But put simply, for me, I think what all citizens need is the opportunity to easily voice their concerns and to be listened to expect organisations to account for themselves by accepting when things have gone wrong, and we don't do that well enough yet, putting things right as quickly as possible, and changing how things are done for the future so that other people are not badly treated. We have research that tells us time and again that those are the kind of things that citizens are looking for. Seems to me that what we have at the moment is perhaps not a web of accountability, but a labyrinth which citizens are expected to navigate. And there are days when I wonder how any of them ever get to us at all. Probably by the goodwill of the local authority, actually, who says, well, we've done our best, go and talk to the local government ombudsman. But it is a labyrinth, and we're in danger, I think, of making that labyrinth much worse. In a world of diverse models of service delivery, we need to be thinking about how we can create a virtuous circle which will provide effective consumer accountability in as much real time as possible, but also give public assurance and drive improvement. I think we've got to be very careful that the web of accountability doesn't actually become a tangled mess. So I'm going to leave you with questions, and I know we've got one workshop session this afternoon where maybe we can explore this a bit more. But I think we need to address these questions in order to assure me of the concerns I've got. The first is, will all new service providers be in a position to handle complaints quickly and effectively? I'm just not sure. What role should local authorities play in ensuring complaints are handled well and acted upon? Is there an onus there to come back to the local state, again, guaranteeing and ensuring the rights of the citizens to complain. What role should, and how can we ensure that learning from complaints is translated into service improvement? We did a bit of work with CFPS earlier in the year thinking about how the corporate responsibility of the local authority might help through scrutiny and other means to ensure that complaints are part of that landscape. And last but not least, how can we ensure that lessons from complainants about the quality of services are fed back to commissioners? And I know this is an issue for some of the work we're doing, adult social care. Local authorities are saying to us, well, you're looking at the way in which complaints are handled against care homes. How are you going to tell us? How are you going to feed back in order that we can get a proper grip on service quality if we're commissioning care? So I'm going to leave it there. Sorry to leave with more questions than answers, but I hope you can see that we've got a tangled web here, and we really need to make sure that we look at that and make it as simple as possible for complainants, for members of the public, for citizens, to hold local authorities and providers to account. Thank you very much.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from policyreview.tv. For more details, go to www.policyreview.tv. Please note that this audio is subject to copyright and cannot be used by other broadcasters or for commercial gain.